I'm Wendy Damondante, and I'd like to welcome you to this session 333, titled Break Open the Vessel, Pour the Oil, Cut the Cords. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive and avoid looking at your cell phone during the session. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the question and answer portion of the session following the remarks of the presenter. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. As you listen today, we invite you to reflect on your connection and access point to the topic. At Sunstone, we never ask anyone to adopt the opinions of others, rather to instead practice curiosity as an act of humility and empathy. Perhaps you'll find things you hear today that will align with your own views, and perhaps you will find yourself challenged by them. At Sunstone, we believe the wrestling with ideas is a critical part of learning and growth. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that presenter, to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow everyone enough time for lunch. We invite you to purchase food from the concessions just outside. Also, there's a couple of presentations during the lunch time. You just might be aware of that. It's a little confusing what rooms they're in. I think there's been a mistake in somewhere, but... well, then this says a little about this session. I think this means Jody, senses that many women are following an inner call to claim direct connection to divine presence and power. This paper looks at the ebb and flow of this movement through the author's life and the often overlooked examples of women in our history and scriptures that offer a great pattern for claiming authority that is greater than any given by men. How much of our hesitation to claim personal revelation comes from the divisive and limiting, but constantly repeated rhetoric of a few men? It is time to cut the cords that bind us to an altar built to the false gods of our fathers. Jody England Hansen, our presenter, is a writer, speaker, activist, advocate, suicide prevention trainer, mixed media artist, and friend to many. And we'll turn the time over to her now.
Thank you. Someone added that friend to many, but I know many have been my friends, and so I appreciate that. So I'm going to kind of be pulling a lot. Okay, we don't need to turn the lights out. It's probably someone in the other room messing around with it. Okay. So I'm going to kind of be taking you on a journey, and it's going to go to a lot of places in the world. I have slides mostly from Egypt, and I'll be mixing those in, but I want to talk a little bit about... some of my heritage, and I hope there will be time where you can share some of yours as well. From the time I was little, I remember a story about one of my great-great-grandmothers who she and her husband were trying to build up a farm, work hard on it. It was isolated, and it was in Idaho, and of course her husband had assignments for the church that took him away from there. And during one of these times when she was there with her very young children, she became very ill and knew that it's possible she could die without help, but had no way to get it, had no way to find help. And she called her children over to her bed and she asked them to bless her. And she said, "Jesus hears the prayers of little children." And they did, and she recovered. And because she knew, if she didn't, all of them would perish. And this is a story that I grew up with. I recently wrote about my earliest memory of Heavenly Mother, or Divine Feminine. It's on the Exponent 2 blog. It happened when I was still in my crib, and it literally is my earliest memory, and kind of cemented a very clear understanding of her presence, even though at the time I did not have the language. I do have the memory, where I could describe it later. My mother, when she was on her mission with my dad, they were sent on a mission together right after they were married back in the early 50s, and they were sent to serve together in Samoa. This is the only instance of that happening that we know of in the 20th century. And while there on a small island in a remote village, my father became ill, and my mother was tending to him and recognized that he had blood poisoning. She saw the red lines going up his arm, and you know, while this was, they were very young. I can't believe it. They were 20, and all she knew to do is to lay her hands on him and bless him. And he recovered. When I was a child and very ill, both my parents would place their hands on my head and to give me a blessing and a healing. I realized that the rhetoric around women participating in healing blessings has gone through many changes, and I appreciate that my dear friend Farah Anderson Sneddon is writing a history of this, and there are many others that have recorded this, and I think we need to acknowledge this is a shifting, living history. And we are participating in it now. So I think it's important that we recognize our ability to actually direct it. When I was pregnant with my third child, my son, it was at a time when there was a great amount of pushback. From specific leaders. It was leading up to, it was in the early 90s. And so what we used to talk about very openly, we were a little more careful about where we spoke of what had happened and what we were interested in, what we did. I had held my first two children, my daughters, when they were blessed. We held the blessings in our home. I would participate in that blessing and planned on doing so with our third child. But while I was pregnant, there were a lot of things that just seemed to be more overwhelming to me. And I asked my sisters and my mother for a blessing. And we had a family gathering, and my sisters and my mother gathered around me and placed their hands on me while the men sat back and watched. And it was interesting because I realized that we, as women, did not have the same constraints of language, that there was more freedom to say what we felt instead of follow a pattern. And in that sense, there was a little more freedom, acknowledging that we had huge constraints because of the rhetoric and pressure to not do that. And then after my son was born, for the first time after my husband gave him a blessing of naming, I gave him a mother's blessing. And again, did not feel the same constraints about what I was saying to him. When I was set apart as an ordnance worker, when we lived in Denver, and I was set apart as an ordnance worker for the temple there, something that really stood out to me during that setting apart, and that is that the temple president said that my power and authority came from Jesus Christ. And there was no priesthood figure mentioned. And I thought that was really interesting and really held on to it. And it reinforced my feeling that ultimately, we need to look at where real power comes from. And mostly, it's that we acknowledge it's within us already and that God will guide us in that. October 2015, the Mama Dragon Story Project was launching, and this is a project where Kimberly Anderson would take photographs of different Mama Dragons, and we would write an essay to go with that, talking about our experience. And for the launch, she had me sharing my essay at Written Vision, and Tom Christofferson also spoke there, and Carolyn Pearson spoke that evening. Carolyn is a friend from way back. And afterwards, we were talking, and this is before the November policy was released, but we were doing all we could to be advocates from wherever we were. And as I was talking with her, and it was moving, it was really powerful, and I began to weep. And she hugged me, and I felt her hands move up, and she placed them on my head. And here we were, in the middle of a lot of people. We were having our own conversation, but she placed her hands on my head, and she pronounced a blessing on me that was very powerful. And again, it was this reminder. We don't need to feel constrained as to being in a certain place or a certain ceremony or a certain language. When we feel moved upon, we have the authority already. And in January 2016, I was just, horrible things had happened all of a sudden. Mike had suddenly been released as bishop without an explanation, and within days the new bishop had released me from teaching gospel doctrine, and I learned from him that he had been ordered to do so by our stake president, who had not talked to us about it. And I was really struggling. It was really difficult at the time. It was only months after the policy. It was just weeks after President Nelson had proclaimed that it was revelation, which we knew was not the case. And it was really difficult. And I was wondering, you know, what am I going to do? And I was pleading with God. And it was the first time in 45 years I had not had a calling. But I was still an ordnance worker and had incredible experiences with the women I served with there. But what came to me was really amazing in this moment of grace with God and the presence of ancestors and support and compassion. And as I went through the time following, the messages that came to me were, why would you wait for someone else's permission to know what to do, to know how to serve? Give yourself a calling. And I knew that conceptually, but this was bringing it, you know, into the experience of living. And every day I gave myself a calling. And the interesting thing is I was really having almost constant conversation with God, with ancestors, as to the time of that day, where to be, what I needed, what others needed. And some pretty amazing things happened. We moved back here to Salt Lake. And following the horrific events of November 2016, I went back east to the Women's March in January 2017. And participated in the march, and then also Sacred Resistance Retreat that was back there. And at the end of the retreat on Sunday evening, there was an expression from several women saying, I wish I could ask you for a blessing. And we were kind of looking at her going, and what's stopping you? And then others there were asking. And several of us had already always, you know, offered and given blessings to each other. But what we learned is that quite a few had never experienced that from their sisters. And so we held blessing circles that went into the evening for quite a while, and it was really wonderful. And once again, each time someone would request a blessing, we would say, how? Do you want to sit? Do you want to lie? Do you want to stand? Where do you want our hands? Do you want only one of us? Do you want just one voice? Do you want all of us to participate? And the freedom of being able to create the experience according to what was felt and needed was really powerful. And at one point, as we had to move from one room in this retreat center into another because it was going on so long, and I had called my husband, and I just said, yeah, the retreat's over. I'm not heading back yet. We're giving blessings to each other. And he knew some of the women who were there. And he said, oh, I wish I could be there and get a blessing from my sisters. And I said, you know, a foundation of this church that we belong to is vicarious work. I can make this happen. And so I spoke with the others, and so what happened is I was vicariously doing the work for Mike. And they gathered around me and laid their hands on me, and I recorded it and sent it to them. And I said, I was your proxy. Your sisters give you this blessing. And I thought it was interesting because when it was over and I stood up and I looked around, I counted, and there were 12 of us. We had created a quorum of women's authority. And then later in that year, Mike and I went for a few days to this small town in Mexico for Day of the Dead. We were there with a group that my sister had put together, and it was really wonderful. It was an incredible experience. It was amazing to see this connection with the dead and the remembering and speaking names every time we visit different cultures. It's really amazing to see how cultures find a way to reach forward and reach back that is so familiar to many of us. And the last, and Mike liked to go out before the sun was up and take pictures in this town, and it was an incredibly wonderful, very safe, historic town. And the last morning, he got up, and it was hours before we were going to leave and catch the plane. And I was still asleep. And I'd always say, you know, wake me up and I'll go with you. And but he'd always let me sleep. And all of a sudden I was awake, and he burst into the room. He was covered in blood. And as he had been taking these pictures of the sun rising up over this town, there were two young men who Mike had figured they were kind of out of it. But he wasn't aware that they were. He had seen them, but he had moved around to do different things, and suddenly they were there, and they wanted his camera and money, and they had a knife, and he managed to resist a little bit because he had no money, but they stabbed him and they knocked him down and they beat him, and he. Landed a well-placed kick and was able to roll away and get away and come back. So I got up, of course, and I'm looking at him, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on, and he's pretty much out of it. He had been knocked out just for a moment, and blood was pouring down his face, and I was trying to see where it was, and then I noticed there were three places where blood was spreading out on the front of his shirt. And as I'm removing his clothing and I see the gashes in his clothing, and I immediately am blessing him. I'm blessing the molecules. I'm blessing the fibers. I'm blessing everything I can think of. I'm calling down every power I can think of. As I'm just thinking, you know, what am I going to do? But I knew that much. I knew I could bless him. I didn't have any other equipment. Didn't know the language. It was about 5 in the morning. And so I pull off his shirt. I pull off his underwear, covered in blood, and I get to his skin. And by the time I get there, I see one small stab mark that's on his rib cage, on his sternum. And the places where the blood was spreading, there's no stab mark. And then I concentrated on his head and could not, you know, he was bleeding out the back of his head and the front, and I couldn't stop that. And at that point, I got pressure on it and went and got help, and we got him to the hospital. So it moments like that are exhilarating and horrifying. I can't explain that. Now, I love mysticism. I really do. And I also love answers. I really love getting information. I like knowing how things work. My favorite part of a DVD is looking at how the movie was made in the background and all the stories and everything. And I've learned that when it comes to claiming power, I can't devote too much energy to trying to explain it. I would have nightmares. So I think part of claiming authority and power is recognizing that sometimes we are more powerful than we realize, and we don't need to understand how. At least not now. So then, pretty much in the midst of this, we went to Egypt. And I had long studied some of the temples and the imagery and the in Egypt, and it was, as you know, it's a whole different experience being there. And this is, I just want to kind of talk about some of the imagery that tells me this is not new. The patriarchy is not new. The things we're dealing with, this is not new. This is a human thing. And also this seeking and recognition of the inherent power in all of us is not new. So Hathor, this is at Dendera, which is one of the most amazing temples there. Hathor is the goddess that is, I think, the closest to the mother goddess. And just in case you don't really recognize it, it looks very similar to the sunstone face. And that's not by accident. All through the temples that we saw, there were amazing depictions that they know about what some of it means, but much of it is a mystery, and many of the explanations as to why this is part of the ceremony or what it's supposed to do or what the power behind it is were lost in the burning of the library, the Great Library of Alexandria. But they piece together what they can, and one thing that I realize is even though it was just Mike and I, and we had our own guide, which, by the way, everyone should go to Egypt, and you should go while it's empty and cheap. We had our own guide and our own driver all day, every day, and it cost us $25 a day. but we could spend all the time we wanted asking questions and trying to get the information that we could have. But one thing that I realized is, again, the mysticisms will hold sway. And there is a deep, deep mystery, magic, whatever you want to call it, behind these images, these journeys, these temples, these rituals. And it has to do, I think, with connection, that we are intimately connected to each other and to a greater power that we will call any number of names, and we will do all we can to try to figure it out. But all of this is about seeking it, ascending to it, journeying through it, finding a way to acknowledge and exercise it. So I really, this was one of my favorite things that I saw, and this was repeated in many ways, but this is at the Temple of Edfu, and these incredible reliefs that were so realistic, and I loved the delightful expression on the faces. But these women are anointing, and there are a number of depictions of the women anointing royalty. And you'll notice the familiar signs, you'll notice the familiar stances, the hands on the shoulder, the connection, and the endowment of offering something, and the joy about it, that this is very much an important part of the journey, that we offer our gifts to each other, and in offering those gifts, we are empowered. This one is a little harder to see, but also a very common image, and it has to do with couples. Bring together of the opposites, the unifying of the opposites that are depicted by men and women, and often brother-sister or god-goddess or married couples. And very often, whenever they are standing there holding hands, the woman is placing the symbol for breath, divine breath, into the man. Patriarchy is strong. You notice the size of the men, size of the women. This is not a new thing. But the thing that I find interesting is, even though in this very human society, as flawed as any of us, where patriarchy was very much a part of things, the greatest and most powerful and essential figures in the journey forward were goddesses. Maat is the goddess that is known for justice and balance. And if you've ever seen, and wisdom, which, by the way, the figurative story in our ritual of Adam and Eve, Eve is wisdom, Eve is the seeking, Eve is the moving forward. It's the part in all of us that seeks the wisdom, the balance of opposition. So in Egypt, the figure of Maat is that. And if you've ever seen any of the depictions of the goddess that has the wings spread out, that's Maat. And she has a feather on her headdress. And similar to the parable of the sheep and the goats that Christ tells, where someone says, ultimately, what do we got to do? What do we got to do to make it? It's a question that we'll all have. And he says, you'll come. You're either going to go here or you're going to go there. And I don't believe in heaven or hell. I think he was talking about our state of being. And they go, but why would we be on this side and not that one? And he goes, it's how you treat each other. Anything and everything that you do, you either recognize that that person is God or you don't. And when you recognize that person is God, you move forward. For Maat, it doesn't matter who you are. Everyone, when they are seeking to ascend and move forward, At one point, their heart will be placed on a scale, and Mott will place the feather on the other side of the scale. If your heart is heavier than the feather because of how you've treated people, no matter what you are, who you were, what station, what you owned, you do not move forward. And it's the woman who depicts this. So it's really important to recognize that there is this need to see that kind of balance, that kind of stability in what can move us forward. Now, of course, those with power would always find reasons to override that. Hapi is one of the most powerful gods, and Hapi is intersex. So here is this god who is recognized as the unifier, the bringing together of the opposing kingdoms and the opposing values. And while he is depicted as a he, I think it's mostly because our guides were not sure about the language for pronouns. They have breasts and a pregnant womb, as well as male characteristics. And so this bringing together of the male and the female, the opposition, and seeing the need for it, or we are doomed. Because without bringing together the opposites, the world would be destroyed. And there's this recognition of that with Hapi. Just going through. This is one of the depictions of the mother preparing her child to escort them forward. They would bury, when someone died before adulthood, they would not bury them near their father. They would bury them near their mother, even though it was far away from the king's tombs or the nobleman's tombs. The women were buried in a separate place, but they would bury the children close to the mother because they did not trust that the father would bother to escort the child forward. They knew the mother would. Again, the recognition of the power of the female. So this is a little harder to see, but if you see the feet here, and here's the figure, and here's the hands here. And this is kind of upside down, but I put the image that way so you can see the beings that are being sheltered. But this is Nut, and she is the goddess that every evening swallows the sun and in the morning births the sun anew. And she is over everything. Nothing happens without her. Another very, very powerful female divine. The women, the goddesses that were depicted, and these are the sisters Isis and Hathor, who basically saved the supreme god by reassembling him after he had been slaughtered and divided by his brother in an attempt to destroy his authority. They are the ones who found the pieces. They are the ones that unified it. And it begins with their grieving as they gather them and their power to unify and bring to life. And they carry those symbols of power with them through the journey. And then Hatshepsut is the pharaoh who was a woman, and she was very powerful in making a big difference in the kingdom, but she recognized that she had to, in a sense, play the game. So she applied a beard for authority. She gave herself the symbols of authority in order to work within the system. And all through many of the buildings there and the tombs, there is the image of the tree. And one of the moving things is when we went into a tomb of one of the noblemen, and there back in the corner, there he and his wife are kneeling before the tree, and the tree is the goddess. I found it interesting that in this image, she did not have the definite distinction that shows which goddess. She is the goddess. And I think when we can return again to appreciating the history of our archetypes, the history of our symbolism and the power of it as symbolic, and I'll be talking about that a lot at my 5 o'clock session, then we can again acknowledge our own journey in this human nature. Whatever system we are living within, we can either wait around for permission or we can take part in claiming it. So one of my favorite, changes all the time. So I think we need to claim our ability to read anything, any story, any scripture, listen to any talk, and make it our own in whatever way it works for us. We might make it our own by going, well, isn't that an interesting way for that very privileged person to see things? That just helps me understand another point of view. Take power over that. In the accounts of the woman who comes to Christ near the end of his life, and she has this precious oil, and she breaks the vessel open. This is not a vessel where you have a reusable covering. You break it open, and it has to be used. And this is very expensive. It is the best she had to offer. And she comes to him, and the account I like is the one where she does not have a specific name, title. It doesn't describe her station or her connection. But she comes to him and breaks it open, and she anoints him. And he recognizes what she is doing. Others don't, but it doesn't stop her, and it doesn't stop him. She anoints him in recognition that he is the Messiah. He is the one that brings life and renewal. She proclaims this because she has the authority that she recognizes the presence of God. No one gave her that authority. She has it. We all do. After she has anointed him, and his followers are saying, why did you let her do that? You know, it could have gone to something much greater. He says, wherever the gospel is taught, this will be mentioned. Now, how often in Sunday school, when someone is teaching the gospel, do they mention this account? We might not specifically mention it, but I think these words of Christ are basically acknowledging we teach the gospel with our own recognition, our own authority to convey the good news. We are each here to acknowledge God in each other and to bring the presence of God into the world by whatever power we have to anoint and proclaim, you are God. You have the power to create life and bring it into salvation in the world. And so I encourage us to recognize we have the vessels. Don't keep them closed. Break them open. What are you saving it for? And then I really love several interpretations of the account of Abraham that is a little different from the one that I grew up with. The Abrahamic test is a very common part of our rhetoric. And I can see the value in it, and it helped me kind of move forward in looking at it closely. But the interpretation I want to offer today, and why that's part of my title, to cut the cords. We have people in our world who are in authority or who feel the weight of some kind of authority. The only thing that they can go on, really, except when they really, really open themselves up to something new, is their background, their bias, their traditions, their own life, and their own life experiences, like all of us. It takes effort to acknowledge, this is what I've always known. Is this how I want it to go? Maybe not. What do I got to do to be open to something new? Not a common occurrence for most of us. So here's a person who has felt a lot of following and authority and responsibility, and he's getting older. Age has an impact on people. And he's got this one son, which was a gift in his old age, and it's the most precious thing to him. And yet he's not really feeling constant acknowledgement. Maybe he's asking questions that he's not getting the answers he thought he would get to, and he's not feeling as acknowledged in his old age. And he's wanting to somehow prove himself. So he thinks God would require the most important thing from him. If he's not hearing from God, he must not be offering enough to God. So what does he need to offer to God to get more answers? Well, here is this precious child. Maybe that's what I need to do. I will sacrifice this child on the God that I know, even though I myself was almost sacrificed on the altar as my father claimed to worship the gods of his fathers. But it wouldn't be that way for mine. I'll bet God wants me to offer my child. And his wife recognizes this and sees it and has to be creative. She doesn't have the calling, the authority, or the position that's recognized by society, but she does recognize it, and that gives her her own calling. And she follows, and as she sees that this child is going to die on the altar of traditional gods, she finds a way to step forward as the angel and say, "Not in my house. You will not slay our children on the altar of past gods. I claim the authority to stop this." We may be laying ourselves on that altar and allowing ourselves to be offered up to past gods. So I invite you to cut those cords, whether it's cords that bind your children, yourself, your siblings, your parents. I invite you to cut those cords. I invite you to pour the oil and anoint each other in the divinity that is ours and the power that is here. I am in a place where I have no problem acknowledging authority within a certain framework. That right now, while I'm a part of it, I acknowledge that as a place. I do not allow that framework to determine how I see what I can do and where this is going in the eternities. So I'm not saying you have to do it my way. I'm saying you have the ability to see how to do it your way. And now I invite you to share ways that you are breaking open the vessel, pouring the oil, and cutting the cords. Thank you. We have a few minutes.
It interesting that Jody gave an example of being proxy for her husband. And at this point in history, we have our proxy work is limited by sexual roles or gender.
Oh, I can tell you right now that there are plenty of times when women are doing proxy work for men.
Yeah, and I
may not say so on the record, but they are.
I did some research for a paper a couple of years ago and discovered that my great-grandmother had been doing proxy work for male relatives. And so I imagine that before our present limited view, there was not so much difficulty in standing as proxy for another. I feel very much as Jody does that we limit ourselves. And I grew up with a very progressive mom and dad, and in some ways. And I read a million times as a young woman Carolyn Pearson's book, Daughters of Light. Does anyone know what that is? So before Farah came along and doing her work, that was something that comforted me a lot and gave me a lot of strength and confidence in myself. I wanted to just tell an experience that I had when I was going through a difficult time in my first marriage, and my husband had become involved with peyote and had invited a couple over to participate in a peyote ceremony at our house. And I was conflicted about it, and as it went on, I became more and more conflicted and really felt trapped and awful and felt that there was a lot of darkness in the room. And I prayed, and a ladder appeared to me, and I saw at the top of the ladder was Jesus. And he said to me, "You don't have to listen to what these people say. You don't have to listen to these men. You don't have to listen. You can come straight to me." And that has had a big impact in my life.
Thank you.
Please forgive me if this is an intrusion. I belong to Lutheran Church of Honolulu, and every second Sunday we have a busing station. And one of the privileges of this gay man is to go when one of the ladies in the congregation lays her hands upon our head, anoints us with chrisma wax, has been set apart and dedicated, and gives a blessing according to each individual's need. They ask, whether it's a man or a woman giving the blessing, is there something specific you need? And it's such a privilege to be blessed by somebody who cares. So don't be afraid.
Thank you.
My name is Janice Allred, for you who don't know me. I was excommunicated in 1995 for my writings about the Heavenly Mother. I still attend church, although I've never been rebaptized. It's very interesting to me now because they are promoting this idea now in the church, Relief Society, and Sunday School, that we have the response. We now have the responsibility for ourselves to learn, whereas apparently in the past everybody believed it was the church's responsibility. And I think to myself, this is very strange. I took the responsibility to learn for myself when I was about age 2. Or perhaps younger, I don't remember. But I have always believed that I had the responsibility to find truth for myself, to find God for myself. And I like to listen to other people, but I always have seen it as ultimately my responsibility. And so, even though I was in 1995 told that I should not write about certain topics or say certain things like about the Heavenly Mother was one. I've continued to do it. I have written much. I have given many, many talks, and I have found great joy and great expansion of mind in pursuing my own way to learn the truth.
And Janice, I acknowledge you for having such a deep impact on this whole conversation, and you always have to me, and I appreciate that. I really do. This is an example of someone who creates their journey and has helped me learn how to create mine.
It's the price of being so short. I wasn't going to say anything, but Janice prompted me. I was at the meeting that we had years ago when we were talking about our mother in heaven, and Janice was one of the organizers, as was her sister, and it was a lovely meeting. The very next day, I was in my bathroom getting cleaned up, getting dressed, etc. And I put liquid mascara on my eyelid. And as per usual, I walked into the bedroom to say my prayers. Well, I had to have my eyes closed, you know, efficient. So I walked in, and I knelt in prayer. And I have quite a flippant personality. So I was talking to my Heavenly Father, and I said, I don't mean to offend you by pursuing the interest in my Heavenly Mother. I'm not taking anything away from you. I just have a need to know about my Heavenly Mother. This is very sacred to me. I hope you'll take it very sacredly. A light, a heat or light, I thought it was light, came through the top of my head as I'm kneeling there, and it comes down through my body, and it's like a warm hug, and there was such love and such peace in this, whatever was going on, and I didn't want to let it go. I wanted to hang on to it as long as I could, but I did eventually stop praying. And my first thought, was that my mother? It was such a beautiful, beautiful experience. And I've never shared it with anybody but my own family. But I wanted to share it with you.
Thank you. I've had women come to me frustrated because they have suddenly felt this desire to know more about the Sacred Feminine or Heavenly Mother. And they will tell me how they go to their bishop and ask him to tell them about her, explain why we don't study her, and then the bishop no shock, might not have an answer and gets tired of it and sends her to the stake president. And same thing. And I'm thinking very specifically, but this is common with several. And they persist because when we want to know our mother, it's a deep yearning and we don't let it go. And eventually people will somehow be referred to me or Janice or somebody who they hear is talking or writing or experiencing her. But my question is always this: why do you go and ask questions of someone who's not interested in that question? It's no reflection on them. You don't need to feel bad about them or yourself because they're not giving you the answer. They just haven't thought to ask the question. We can go to the source. And one of the times when I said that, and I said, go to the source. And she said, but what source? And I go, ask her. She is a part of us. If there's anything we can ask, it's questions of her.
Jody, do you have any constructural advice on individuals who are taking that authority, and especially women who are blessing their children in the home and really claiming that personal authority without permission, without asking that permission, and yet the realistic consequences of their children raising their hand in primary and saying, well, Mom gave me a blessing, right? So just how do we also move within the system where we're very clearly aware that there can be limitations, misjudgments, consequences for claiming that authority? Any thoughts for this younger generation who is trying with children where, I don't even know what I'm asking, I'm just, how do we also practice this within the context of the structure, knowing that it's the structure isn't ready yet?
If I had the single right answer, I would have written a book and made a lot of money. I have experienced in my own life a lot of impact, a lot of it negative. I mostly concentrated on the positive. We heard from Janice about very real consequences. And so, yeah, it's real, and I don't want to minimize that. Blacklisting, releases, excommunications, threats for discipline. And what I tell people about my own experience in learning to own my journey is I hold my cards close. I'm speaking very freely here, but this is what it's for. At church, I see church as a place where we invite the Spirit of Christ in, and we honor the other people in the room as to how we do that. So being very careful about seeing what people are ready for and saying it in such a way that there's a loving feeling and a connection feeling, that's what I seek at church. Same thing with my leaders. I've learned to be very careful. Someone having a calling does not automatically imbue them with the ability to understand nuance. And for the most part, what happens in your home, it's nobody's business. So I do not encourage people to go in and make sure their bishop knows this is what they felt to do in their home, unless they feel that it is an important aspect of their being involved in the community. But for the most part, they're going to deal with people who aren't ready. They haven't asked that question. And I ask people not to assume that just because this is an important thing that you feel guided to do, you should tell your bishop. People overshare with their authorities. A lot. Women in our ward used to come to me and say, I need to go and talk to your, this is when Mike was bishop, I need to go and talk to your husband about, you know, I get this infection when I wear garments, and I go, he doesn't need to know that. He doesn't want to know that. Do what you need to do for your health. You know, we give each other permission for that. And yes, kids say things in primary. Oh, my word. If I went to the bishop with everything kids said in primary, he would have been disciplined. So yeah, we're dealing with a lot of leadership roulette. I know of a woman who just 2 weeks ago, her bishop encouraged her to hold her child in sacrament meeting while it was being blessed. Yeah.
So that makes me think, too, that maybe with claiming that power and authority, also setting up children for success in those interactions, not trying to hide or create secrets within our home, but talking about that sacred nature, and maybe other people wouldn't understand moms giving blessings, or maybe, so just, I'm trying to think about structurally, how do we help our kids be successful within systems? And so maybe there's that conversation about what's practiced within the understanding of church and what's practiced within our home, what is sacred within our home.
See, that's a really good point, because this is not a Mormon thing at all. This is how it is everywhere. I think it is important to teach your children here at home. Here's how we invite this to happen. Here at home, this is how we talk about this. At school, what is it that you can do that's effective without, you know, doing something that belongs here at home? At work, at church, when you're at your friend's home, are you going to insist that they, you know, say a blessing like you do, pray like you do, treat each other like you do? I think it's an important skill. And in the parent advocacy groups that I belong to, this comes up a lot, where people say, this happened at church, I'm going to get my kids out of there and protect them, and it's never going to happen again. People rely on rhetoric and tradition as an excuse to harm each other everywhere. I'm not saying that you should, you know, not do something like that. Just recognize we do need to teach our kids to own their journey. And part of it may involve you're going to deal with pushback. And we're here for each other. Wendy, did you have?
No, it's time.
It's time.
And thanks for coming. I really appreciate Sunstone and Jody for creating this sacred space where we could share our narratives. And it's lunchtime, an hour and a half, but like I said, at 12:45, there are some presentations that begin. So 2 o'clock for the standard sessions.
Thank you.